I feel that those people are almost getting ignored.
Because
the world's been taken over with, you know, with some 19-year-old girl who says she's got anxiety issues because she, you know, because she's been looking at Instagram all day. Hey guys, it's Matt Haycox here, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycox Show. It's a live one today, not recorded on live for a while, so exciting and nervous in equal measures. But I'm here today with Rachel Kelly. Rachel is a best-selling author, she's a keynote speaker, media commentator, and she's a mental health expert, and also quite specifically, she's an ambassador for Rethink Mental Illness, for SANE, for the Counselling Foundation, and for Head Talks. And I mean, look, mental health is very topical at the moment. It's Mental Health Awareness Day, I think, and Rachel was saying, in about 10 or 11 days' time. But I think, you know, for me, mental health is something we hear about day in, day out, whether it's on, you know, Instagram, in the media, in the workplace, you know, whether it's a work thing, a social thing, a family thing. I don't think there's anyone nowadays who hasn't, been affected in some way, shape or form by mental health. So when I was offered the chance to get Rachel on here, I obviously jumped at it. So Rachel, thanks a lot for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It also sounds a bit daunting, all that list of things. I suppose when I say I'm an expert, the word expert comes from experience. And I think that's what I've got, you know, maybe I hope I can offer to listeners, is just a bit of an experience of what this whole world is about. So, yeah, that's where I come in.
Just before we get into the specifics of mental health and you know, your story about that particularly, take us back to the beginning. I think your career started in journalism. Just give us a bit of context.
Yeah. So I was a sort of driven, quite high achieving sort of type. I went to a sort of competitive school. Went to school in London, St Paul's Girls' School. Went to Oxford, and then I joined the Times newspaper in my early 20s in the newsroom. So it's quite a high pressure job, but quite exciting. And all seemed to be well for a bit. But then my mental health story really started in my 30s when I had my first major depressive episode. And yeah, I crashed and burned pretty badly, ended up in hospital. Yeah, so I could tell you a bit more about that if you like.
Had you ever suffered prior to that? Had you experienced anything, any smaller episodes?
It's interesting because I think at the time I kind of thought it'd come out of nowhere because it was quite dramatic. I was very physically unwell. I was in a lot of physical pain. And actually, I thought at the time I was having a heart attack, and it felt unlike anything I'd had before. But actually now, after years of therapy and sort of looking back, and I realized that quite an anxious child, always sort of very goal-driven, always the next thing, never feeling quite good enough. I'd always had bits of insomnia, always a bit anxious about sleeping. Yeah, so I think there were little sort of back squeaks, as it were. It wasn't like the full-blown episode, but with a lot of therapy looking back, I realised that the warning signs were there.
And would you say that, I mean, I think it was the Times you said you were working for at the time. I mean, obviously that's a very high profile, you know, undoubtedly very high pressure environment. I mean, did that cause your problems? Did it amplify them?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think up to about 2 or 3 years ago, I would have very much put the episode in the context of the stress that I was encountering. And, you know, I do think that was really important. So it was very high pressure. So this was the first episode was actually quite a while back, 1997, when I was in my 30s. And, you know, even then it was a really 24-hour environment in the newsroom. So I think it's an issue that a lot of people have now with the digital world of like boundaries and when do you stop. But I could be rung by my news editor at sort of 10 o'clock at night and he'd say, oh, look, the Guardian has splashed on some story. Could you do me a follow up? And that would be writing 600 words, high speed, ring my contacts. And I also think that, you know, when we're thinking of psychological well-being, you really have to also think of the context, you know, your family context. So my husband, still my husband. So he worked in finance. He was pulling all-nighters. He was sort of eating pizza, meeting deadlines. And we also had two small children. And the thing about that is it's very chronic. by which I mean ongoing, the stress of two small children. And it is also round the clock. And I mentioned to you that insomnia. So I think that sense of small children being up at night, and if you put that all together, that is quite a kind of cocktail of stressors. You probably have heard of this idea of a stress bucket. You know, everyone's got a sort of certain amount that they can deal with. And then if you add
I personally haven't, and I'm sure plenty of people listening haven't as well. So maybe tell me more about that. And
So it's just the idea that you know, we're all designed to deal with a certain amount of stress. So we're actually all the descendants evolutionarily of people who had a good stress response. You know, fear, fight or flight, the stress response came when there was a stressor. So we all ran away when we saw the lion, and we're all the descendants of those people. And so we are designed to have a stress response, and a stress response is fine in itself. So for example, like you mentioned, you're feeling a little bit nervy about the podcast. So at that point, you're feeling slightly stressed. You know, you rise to the occasion, you focus, you do all the things that like your heart might beat a little bit faster to sort of pump the blood round. Your mind would have focused. You dealt with the stress and you came through it. You completed the stress cycle and you were fine. And now we're having a good chat. So I suppose the idea of the sort of stress bucket and the stress response is they're kind of connected ideas, is that if you put in too many stressors in a sort of bucket of water effectively, so you add in a stressful job, a stressful relationship, your partner's got a stressful job, you've got small children, the bucket overflows and it's just too much and you become overwhelmed. And you can, instead of having a short-term appropriate stress response to something, which is, you know, my news editor's asked me to write a stressful story, not a stressful story, asked me to write a story, I deal with that. I cope, I manage, and I come back down, and the water comes back down to a manageable level. Basically, the idea is that you just got too much, you can't cope, and your stress response stops working effectively, and you can't deal with the stressors and the anxiety that you're facing.
Okay, I'm with you.
Yeah. So I think, as I say, I very much took that outward approach to what happened to me before, that it was a lot about circumstances. And I think as I've got older, I've become a bit more nuanced. And now I think that it is true, people who are anxious or facing a lot of stress, circumstances do matter. But there's this big bit of us, which is how we decide to approach circumstances. So it is also what's going on inside us, the idea that for all of us, our main relationship is with ourselves. We do have a capacity to choose how we respond to these outward stresses. So in my case, I had a lot of stresses, but what I hadn't done is any work on myself, looking after myself, my relationship with myself, how I chose to respond. I mean, there were things I could have done. I could have said like, hey, you're giving me too much work. Hey, I need my mum to come and stay to look after the kids for a night. Hey, you know, I need you, my husband, to take over. I didn't do any of that. I didn't have any sense of sort of looking after myself or self-care or how I might respond to the stressors. So I think that's how I now look at it now, that it's a bit of both. It isn't just the stress you're under that can lead to serious anxiety-driven depression, but it is also how you choose to respond to it.
It's interesting when you say about, you know, how you choose to respond to it, because I go to every year I go to what I call my fat camp, and September, October time, I go on a kind of a 10-day juice cleanse at, you know, at some kind of detox retreat somewhere, you know, normally Portugal or Spain or wherever it may be. And I always go on my own. It's always, you know, quite a nice chill time. But I was there last year. It was a new hotel, never been to it before, and I went to see the various different people of the different disciplines. So, you know, spent some time with an acupuncture lady, spent some time, you know, with a chiropractor, spent some time with an aesthetic aesthetic medicine type lady, and with all of them, we're having a bit of general chit chat before you know, before we got into whatever their discipline was, and they all said to me, how are your stress levels? And I'd always say to each one, zero. You know, I'm very relaxed. I've got no stresses at all. Because that's kind of how I'd always felt up until that point. And every one of them, all completely independently, every one of them said, Well, why are you lying to me? I'm looking at you, and you've got, the shoulders of an incredibly stressed guy, or the tongue of a straight, or whatever it was they look at. They're all saying to me, "You look incredibly stressed. You're like one of the most stressed people we've ever seen." And I was saying to them, "No, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm cool, honestly. I'm very relaxed, always in a good mood." And I went back to my room after 2 or 3 days of this. I'm thinking, why the hell are all these people telling me I'm so stressed? When to me I'm not. I think it was only then that it really actually dawned on me that, you know what, I actually am, or certainly at that point, I actually was probably unbelievably stressed about many, many different things. But it's just that I guess I just got on and dealt with it, or hid it well, to 99% of the outside world, because I guess I took the view that I just need to get on and do the things, or get on and perform. And I actually, when I sat back that night and realized that, you know what, I actually am, pretty stressed about many things, I sat down to kind of write down what I thought the things were that were winding me up or causing me stress. And it's funny because most of them, well, not most, I think all of them were to do with relationships with other people. I don't mean, not boy-girl relationships or even friendships, but primarily work-related things where I was hiring people that weren't performing. And I was ultimately, getting wound up that I'm paying these people and they're not delivering. And, I guess, one layer on top of two, layered on top of three, four, five. And I sat down in my bedroom that night and wrote down all the people I was paying that were doing, that just weren't delivering for me. And I woke up the next day, rang them up, and either fired them or cancelled the contracts, and canned the outflow of cash. And then I just felt like, even though I didn't realize I was stressed the day before, my shoulders took a big shh, and all of a sudden I was genuinely very relaxed again. Although I think 12 months on, that's built up, and I've now got another batch of contracts I need to cancel so I can be relaxed again.
Well, listen, hats off to you, because that actually, well, as you say, with the help of those experts at that course, you had that self-awareness of actually being more conscious of what was going on and what was going on, especially in your body, because stress does have a kind of completely, in the old days, we split mind and body. There was this French scientist called René Descartes. It gives us the word Cartesian, and the Cartesian model is a sort of split of mind and body. And that's actually still how a lot of people look at mental health, that it's all just up in your head, whereas actually it absolutely isn't. And stress is also bodily, and it is embodied. So it's very interesting that you had to bring your awareness and realize what was going on. And I was exactly the same. I mean, when I look back at what happened to me, I mean, it's amazing how incredibly ill I was, and I was in complete denial. That it was something going on with my stress levels and my emotions and my psychological well-being, and what was happening, in all the sort of stories in my head. And what I absolutely didn't do was actually what you then did, was actually do something about it. So my thing just got worse and worse. Like, my heart was racing. I was very nauseous. I was throwing up, and I had these sort of racing thoughts, like, if I don't get sleep, I can't get to work. I can't get to work. I'll lose my job. I'll lose the house. I'll lose the children. This sort of very catastrophic thinking. And by the time this sort of went on and on, and like I was getting iller and iller. I mean, I was just in such pain. As I say, when I got to the hospital, I still didn't think it was anything to do with stress, psychological well-being, how I was approaching things. As I say, I just thought it was a heart attack. And the doctor said, no, this is like an anxiety-driven major depressive episode. But the problem was, for me, by that point, I was so ill, and the illness had sort of gripped me. And it wasn't a question of quickly, maybe coming down to a 4-day week, or, as you say, reorganizing some of the relationships around me, maybe saying I'd rather work with a different news editor, all the things I could have done. And yeah, I was pretty ill for 6 months, and I was in this hospital, and I became really suicidal. I was sort of screaming, saying I want to die, and because I just felt so ill. And then, you're not going to really believe this because it just sounds so crazy. So there's much more awareness now, as you said in your introduction. But in 1997, I just went back to work, and I just didn't change anything. I didn't think of changing, my circumstances or my approach to my circumstances. And my luck held for a bit, but then I had another really bad depressive episode, and it was a similar way. Started with insomnia, then all these horrible sort of stress response syndromes, so the fear, fight, or flight response. So, you know, your heart races to pump more blood round, you empty your stomach so you can run faster, your mind's racing to grip the fear, but you never end that response, and you never actually change anything so that you're not in this incredibly stressed state. And then again, it morphed into serious depression. And yeah, that time I was ill for best part of 2 years. And, you know, amazingly, it was only then, after having been so ill for so long, because then I started on a whole load of medication, so antidepressants, sleeping pills, anti-anxiety medication, and then I had lots of problems adjusting to the medication, and, you know, I was a zombie for a lot of the time. And it was only really after that been going for the best part of 2 years, which was about 10 years ago, that I thought, okay, maybe my body's trying to tell me something. You know, maybe there's something I need to look at in my circumstances and how I look after myself, that I can't cope with this level of stress. I've got to do something about it. But that was how far I pushed myself, which just seems really crazy now.
So let me ask you something then, which is almost like the opposite of what you and I have just been talking about then. And I guess, you know, probably, you know, not a particularly PC question in today's world, but obviously you talk about the fact that after your episode, you kind of, you know, you didn't fix it and you just got back on with it and went back to work.
Yeah.
But I was talking about the fact that, you know, I didn't even identify. I was even stressed at that
yeah.
point
yeah.
and like lived in denial, let's say. For me, I feel there's a massive culture of the opposite of that nowadays, that, you know, everybody's got anxiety. Everybody's got, you know, and it's almost like, I'm not going to say fashionable, but, you know, anytime anyone has a problem of any minor degree of magnitude, it's almost like a get out to say, mm-hmm. you know, I've got an anxiety issue, or I've got a mental health issue. When, you know, I mean, ultimately, you know, in many aspects of life, many aspects of business, the bottom line is, you know, that they are going to be high pressure, high stress things. You know, if you want to get well paid to do a job, or either if you're going to be a doctor in a stressful environment, or you're going to be a successful business person, or you want to be a lawyer and work to deadlines, etc. You know, these things undoubtedly come with deadlines, you know, which bring pressure, but are to a degree part of real, you know, the real world. And I'm not for one minute, you know, playing down, you know, real people with real problems. But sure. what's your opinion? I mean, what is your opinion on that?
Yeah.
You know, nowadays, everyone just uses it as an excuse to not do what they need to do.
A couple of points I'd make on that. I think the first point is about language and how we describe things. And I think you're absolutely right that there's a problem, because there's different things. There's a mental health condition when you're suffering from severe depression, and then they're saying, I'm feeling depressed. And they're obviously not the same at all. There's a difference for feeling anxious and actually suffering from anxiety as a mental health condition. So what I would say is that if you took the sort of the entire population, by far the biggest two topics on mental health generally, for say 95% of the population, are anxiety and depression. And I would say of that 95% of the population, a very small percentage have a mental health condition whereby it's more than, as you say, what we expect, everyday stressors, learning to cope with them, ways of dealing with self-care. And there's been a confusion because the two things have got muddled up, partly because the language isn't clear. And what I would say for that very large cohort, which is some data at the moment is saying 10 million people are suffering from anxiety. And
in the UK or the
UK, just in the UK. And you know, it's crazy because
impossible.
First of all, they're not suffering from anxiety in the way that it's a medicalized condition, which completely is debilitating and you cannot lead your life. You cannot do your job. That is a very different thing. I think we've got to be really careful now that big, you know, as I say, there's sort of the 95%. We don't go down a kind of medicalized solution. We don't label them as having a mental health condition. We can be sympathetic and alongside people and say, yes, people have stressful lives, but there are really good ways of looking after yourself a bit better. That does not mean to say you have a mental health problem. you do not have a mental health condition, you do not necessarily have to go on any kind of medication, and you do not have to bother the NHS. For most of those people, the big change, and you already nailed it, is relationships at work. So for people who are in work, I mean, obviously your mental health is affected by your life at home, other areas where you basically spend your time. But for a lot of that big main cohort, if we had a more supportive and encouraging workplace where people could be a bit more flexible, a lot of that depression and anxiety, I think, would diminish. So I'm actually quite positive that there are things that we can do that do not need to go down the medicalized route. Now, I would say that there is a different group, and there is a sort of 2 or 3% group, which is quite different. They're not people often in work. They've got poor housing. They've often had adverse childhood stress. They have things like schizophrenia, psychosis, a whole nother world of mental health, which is not really the mental health you see in the headlines. It's not really the mental health that you hear very often about the celebrities. Most of the celebrities that talk about mental health, they're on the sort of more safe mental health, as it were, which is, as I say, is back to anxiety and depression, which is much more fluid and much harder to sort of, you know, much more muddled up. But as I say, there is this 2 or 3% who do have much more severe and serious problems, much more long term. And I think, you know, the way that the sort of mental health conversation has gone,
to me,
yeah, sorry.
Well, I was going to say to me, and it may, you know, like I say, it's probably, you know, wrong, or I'm sure probably considered inappropriate to say, but, you know, to me, this 2 or 3 or 4% that you talk about, you know, the ones with psychosis or schizophrenia,
yeah,
I feel that those people are almost getting ignored.
Because
the world's been taken over with, you know, with some 19-year-old girl who says she's got anxiety issues because she, you know, because she's been looking at Instagram all day, and only seven people have liked the picture.
You nailed it, and it's a very, very serious problem, because the thing is if the sort of 95%, as it were, decide that they've got this medical condition and that they've got to rush and, you know, get NHS help, I mean, there's no way the NHS can possibly cope. And absolutely, as you say, the ones that do have a really serious problem are not getting the focus, and they're not getting the support. And they're being muddled in with people who do not have a mental health problem. They just have everyday life stressors, everyday, I mean, you know, stress.
I tell you, I was trying to hire someone recently, and, you know, and anyone who listens to me regularly will, you know, will know about my daily and weekly moans about the difficulties of trying to hire staff in today's climate. And I was trying to hire a guy, a digital marketing position, guy who wanted to work from home. No, I have a completely different conversation for another day, but I'm not a fan of the work from home culture. However, I've come to the realization that, you know, I have to embrace it if I'm going to continue to you know, be an employer in today's world. So I will consider hybrid scenarios for the right people. But this particular guy, he said he wanted to work from home for 5 days a week. I said, it's absolutely not going to work for me. But, you know, whilst we get to know each other, you can do 2 to 3 days in the office, 2 to 3 days from home. And when we're comfortable with each other, and I know that, you know, you're doing the work when you're at home, we can talk about it a bit more. And yeah, we got through 2 or 3 or 4 hours of interviews, of tests, of what do you call it? You know, practical examples. And the guy then accepts a job he says he really wants, because of, you know, wants to work with me, wants the varied scenario, etc. A couple of days before he's supposed to start the job, gives back word because he says that he's done a test run on getting to the office, and he's been on the bus, and taking the bus from his house to my office is not going to be good for his mental health, and is going to give him mental health issues. Now, I'm sorry, but that, for me, that is just unacceptable to use those kind of words. For what? Now, again, look, I could be being completely unfair and inappropriate and diminishing the problem. But to me, the guy just wants to sit at home all day. He doesn't want to take the bus. And yeah. and it's an insult to anyone with a genuine mental health issue that he wants to use those words to get out of taking a job on.
Well, look, I sympathise, and I think there's a lot in what you say. But I think if we go back one layer, the problem we've got is that, you know, there is no blood test to to say you have a mental health problem. There is no brain scan yet, which you could go to a doctor and show that something's wonky in your brain. We only have a kind of self-diagnosis, effectively. It's something called the DSM, the Diagnosis and the Statistical Manual, which is basically what it means is that you if you're not feeling great, you go to see a psychiatrist and you self-diagnose what you think is wrong. And there's about 30 questions. And the one first question says, you know, are you sleeping more or less than usual? Are you taking more or less joy than usual and normal activities? You know, do you have some of these other symptoms? And you more or less, you know, can diagnose yourself. And people who are skeptical, you know, they've done basically they've got the same person go to six different psychiatric hospitals and come out with six different diagnoses. So I'm not saying that the profession of psychiatry is, you know, they're not charlatans. They are trying to help people. And it is true that some people are very seriously ill, but there is a problem with diagnosis in mental health conditions. And I think that is something to bear in mind. And in some ways, because I was just so incredibly ill, you know, I'm trying to tell you, can I give you a sense of how ill I felt? It was a bit like,
I was going to ask that.
Yeah, did you ever have like toothache when you're going to have like a tooth out without anaesthetic, like you're in screaming agony? Or another way I thought of it is, I don't know if you've ever been on a plane when you're going to do a crash landing and you're sort of like this and your stomach's gone crazy and your head's going crazy and you think the plane's going to crash. And it's like that, but it just never stops. So I'd be screaming, going, oh, I'm going to crash, I'm going to crash. And I mean, it was very extreme. And in that sense, I think I wasn't lucky, because I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but I was lucky in the sense that there was no question that I was obviously very unwell. But you're quite right that it is already structurally a difficult area. You know, people say it's like breaking your arm. It isn't like breaking your arm. We don't have the same diagnostic tools. So there is always going to be a degree of confusion about diagnosis and who actually's got a problem and who hasn't. So, yeah.
Tell me, when did you, I mean, obviously in the depth of those, you know, horrendous feelings for yourself, when did you actually see the light at the end of the tunnel? You know, what made you realise that you actually could come through this and could recover?
Well, it wasn't like a sudden moment. So I remember the doctor saying to me, it was a bit like, if you imagine the outline of sort of Himalayan peaks, you get a bit better and then you drop back down and then you get a bit better and you drop back down. But then little by little over time, the sort of the line smooths out and you begin to sort of, you know, slowly be able to do things like dress yourself, wash yourself, feed yourself, all the sort of basics like, you know, you really couldn't do. And sort of little by little, you start, there's sort of the ups and downs become less extreme and it starts to sort of even out. And then little by little, then I came out of hospital, and then there was a big moment when, you know, I could go to the hospital as an outpatient. And then, you know, there was little by little was sort of adjusting the medication and then little by little coming down and coming off the medication. So there were sort of steps to recovery. I think psychologically a big moment for me was that it felt like a real, really pointless, like, oh my God, what, you know, this is just a utterly useless and dreadful experience with absolutely no value. And my mum was sitting by my bed, and I love poetry and also I'm religious, and she would be reading bits of the Bible and bits of poetry, and she read me this line from Corinthians, which is in the Bible, and she said, my grace is sufficient for thee, my strength is made perfect in weakness. And that line was a real turning point. My strength is made perfect in weakness, because it gave me a sense that there was some point to this experience. So my strength would come through stronger. My strength would be made perfect through this weakness. And it is true that I don't think it was really true the first episode, because I didn't really bother to change anything or look after myself. But after the second episode, I really then put a lot of work into looking after myself. And I do now feel super duper stronger than before. And if I come back to that idea that your main relationship is with yourself, then I feel I've got a much better relationship with myself. And as a result, I have much better relationships with people around me.
So, I mean, let's talk about things that people can do. I guess either as a preventative measure or a recovery measure. And obviously, like you say, your case was very extreme, and I know it involved medication. I mean, was yours an unfixable situation without medication, do you think?
I think at that extreme suicidal point, I was just screaming for the medication because I felt so desperate that I mean, I think now once I started recovering, so especially after the second major episode, I started pulling in other ways to get better. And if I was addressing people about like how to look after yourself, I suppose one of the things I would say was bear in mind that principle of that mind and body are completely interconnected. So all those things you know about, like the exercise and, it's like a mild antidepressant, getting enough sleep. There's a big field, nutritional psychiatry. And actually, I've done a few books on, just leaning across, I've done a few books on sort of ways to look after yourself. But one of the things I did, I don't know if, which way that way. Book called The Happy Kitchen. So one of the things about 4 years ago, no, 5 years ago, I went to see my GP and I was doing some of the mindfulness and some of the breathing exercises, and I'd done a lot of therapy. So though therapy is obviously more a psychological approach, and I can come to some ideas there which were really helpful for me. But as I was leaving, she said, "What about happy foods?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, oily fish,
Chocolate.
dark chocolate, got magnesium." And I said, "Oh wow, I've heard of diets for cancer." And she said, "Well, there's this new field, nutritional psychiatry." And I've got really into it, and I did do this book, The Happy Kitchen. And it is true that our mood and our food are very connected. So you remember that idea of the two systems, mind body, same thing. So I think it'd be fair to say that in the old days, very simplistic, but we used to think that mental health was just in the head. And now we think that there's something called the vagus nerve that links the head and the stomach. And doctors now talk about the stomach and the digestive system as like the second brain. So we send as many messages from our stomach to our head as our brain to our stomach, as from our brain to our stomach. This is sort of constant messaging. And so you'll have heard of serotonin, it's the happy hormone, people say. So 90% of it is made in your gut. So this whole idea of improving your gut health, improving your mental health. So I think that's a big topic of just realizing the interconnectedness and then actually putting into action some of these sort of physical strategies. But then, as I say, there's some really important psychological approaches that have made a big difference as well.
And what about advice and tips for how you can deal, or maybe how you can identify and deal with family members, work colleagues, friends who are suffering?
Yeah, it's a really good point. Well, I think that notwithstanding the fact that, as you say, a lot of people do still are now having this conversation and talking about mental health in a way that they certainly weren't when I started. Well, I mean, I really started working as a sort of advocate and researcher and knowing about this area in, well, about 2012. So, I mean, it has changed a lot, the landscape. But in certain worlds, there still is quite a bit of stigma. And people don't think it's kind of, job enhancing to put their hand up and say that they're finding life difficult. So, one thing you can do, which I found quite effective, is you might want to start with a physical topic. So you could just say something like, "Oh, you look a bit, look, you're looking a bit tired. Are you okay on your sleep?" or something like that. So you could start quite gently on a physical thing, and then that might elicit an openness about something more psychological that's going on for them, like rumination. They're going round and round in their heads on worry or catastrophic thoughts or some of the sort of negative ways of thinking that do are associated with anxiety and depression. So that's quite a good way, is start with a little physical thing. Another thing is just to make it very small. Don't say, "Oh, Matt, how are you feeling about the world, the universe, life?" Just say something like, "How was that coffee?" or "How was your lunch?" or just something very small. And just again, starting to see if you, because a little bit like you were saying with that employee, like build a bit of confidence, bit of trust, and then try and work out what's actually happening to that person. So yeah, I think and sort of keeping it low key, maybe going in with a physical idea. Those are both good strategies.
So, and talking of good strategies, I think you've got six books now, haven't you? Six books that undoubtedly are full of good strategies, advice, and stories. Give yourself a plug. Tell us about some of the books and the contents and where we can find them. Presumably, they're
Yeah,
all
that's
on Amazon and eBay and.
yeah, so I suppose it sort of slightly depends. I don't know sort of what stage you're at. I mean, I think my first book was called Black Rainbow, and it's a sort of memoir of this time of being really, really unwell. So it's more for really feeling pretty desperate. And at that stage, I had to really go deep, spiritual, I'd say. And that was partly why poetry meant a lot to me. So that book's got sort of 50 really amazing poems to sort of hold on to and recite and tell yourself a different story, often in the most stunning and beautiful language. So, it's not me writing the poems, but these are the greats, the great writers, Gerald Manley Hopkins or Eliot or incredible writers who sort of know what suffering feels like, and you can feel that they're on your side. So I'd say that would be the book for real desperation. I then did a book called Walking on Sunshine, which was much sort of more light touch, really. And it was for when I was already, able to cope more or less, but beginning to sort of build up this sort of toolbox. And there's some sort of physical ideas in there. So one of those strategies is using some of the breathing exercises. So I do like the breathing exercises because if you think about anxiety, you're often throwing into the future, like you're worried about something that's going to happen, or you're regretting the past. So like when I was really ill, like, oh my God, I won't get to work, or damn, I've taken on too much, I shouldn't have said I could look out for the children tonight, or whatever it is. But essentially, you're not in the present. And this might sound really obvious, but you can only breathe in the present. And if you breathe in a way, in a particular way, which is basically always in through the nose, because there's little hairs on your nose, get that air to the right temperature and stop the bugs. And it's always out through the mouth. But and you always do the out breath longer than the in breath. Now that triggers the relaxation system and it brings us into the present moment. It doesn't necessarily solve the problem, but it triggers a relaxed response. And so if you're relaxed physically, you're relaxed mentally. If you're tense mentally, you're tense physically. And it allows you to come to a better decision about whatever is stressing you at that point. So that book, Walking on Sunshine, has got quite a lot of physical strategies, some of these breathing ones, a few others, some of the nutritional ideas. But it's got a lot of psychological strategies as well. And I'd say that quite a lot of them are about this idea, your relationship being with yourself. So one of the big things for me was not looking for yourself where you're not. So by that I mean needing outward approval, outward affirmation, other people telling you that you're marvelous. So my life was always about I needed the news editor to say I was okay. I needed my husband to say I was okay. I need you, Matt, to say I'm this brilliant guest on your podcast. And I've got to
I
the stage,
will, don't worry, I will.
whatever. But what I'd like to feel now is that lovely if you do, but you know what? I'm okay anyway. So that's a big psychological change. And there's some few ideas in that book about how to stop looking for yourself where you're not. One image I like is not just like it's almost childish, like having to pat yourself on the head, needing somebody to pat you on the head, like pat yourself on your own head. You're just okay anyway. So that's one big sort of psychological shift. And I think the other one that I've written about quite a lot is sort of moving away from a goal-driven approach in life. So telos is the Greek word for goal. And most of us live by goals. And of course, we do have to have goals, finish the book, get the podcast done, do your show. But if you can have a bit of a more atelic approach, so it's just a sort of tilt of the rudder, which is more being process driven. So enjoying the process. So we're just having this great chat right here, right now. We're not thinking, whoa, this is going to go viral. I'm going to suddenly be super famous. It's going to do this. It's going to lead to some goal. I'm just enjoying it in the process right here, right now. Anyway, so that book's got some stuff there. And then actually quite related to what we were talking about earlier, I did another book called Singing in the Rain, and that is a workbook that you fill in, sort of take agency and feel empowered rather than always blaming other people or blaming circumstances or, blaming everybody else, is actually saying, you know what, I have some agency. I can look after my mental health. So that it's full of exercises you can do. And then I did the one about nutrition. Yeah, and my mum died a couple of years ago, and I've just gone back to poetry for the next one because I had to go deep again.
Well, a book for, I guess a book for every occasion and every stage.
In
I
a
mean, listen,
way, yeah.
it's been great. It's obviously been great having you here, Rachel. And I'm sure the guys at home are going to want to learn more. I'm sure some people are going to want to find and download some of your books. But I mean, where can people find you? You got a website? You got an Instagram?
I have. I never remember all the details, but I think it's rachelkelly.net, and then I'm on Instagram, Rachel F. Kelly, and then my books, that they're on Amazon. I know we're not really supposed to say that, so they're on Wollstone. So
Of course you can. You can search on Amazon. No rules on here.
okay, and they're pretty, most book, well, not all bookshops have got them, but you can certainly get them online. And then I'm on Twitter as well. So yeah, I mean, I like actually I use the social media to sort of share fresh research, what's going on, and because there's a lot happening in this field, actually, especially in the nutritional psychiatry. So that's what I try and do with the social media, and just stay connected and hear what people's issues are actually.
Perfect. Well, I'll make sure I give you a plug so the guys at home can know where to find you as well. And
No.
Rachel, thanks again for being here. It's been great to chat to you. And as we said at the beginning, such a I guess such a relevant and topical subject at the moment. Guys, thank you very much for listening to me. As always, if you are watching the videos, you can get me on the audio stuff on Spotify and on iTunes. If you're listening to the audio after the fact, I'm on YouTube. Instagram, Facebook, and pretty much anywhere you want to look from a social perspective. I'm always the Matt Haycox. That's TheMattHoyCox. If you like what you listen to, press like, leave me a comment, give me a share, tell your mates, and leave me a review. And until the next time, I'll see you soon. Thanks again, Rachel.
Thank you.